Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. In this episode, we discuss why Liz Truss must take the axe to the nanny state and to the blob. We ask the question, is James O'Brien Britain's premier conspiracy theorist? And we answer your questions in our postbag section. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Bonjour.
There you go. Different intro every time. We're delighted to be joined today by Sam Ashworth-Hayes, who's journalist, commentator, written some great stuff for Spiked recently as well. I'm glad to say, Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about a bunch today. I think we're going to start off with Liz Truss. I mean, she's got a lot on her plate at the moment. I'm not trying to claim the nanny state is unimportant, but this is a nanny state podcast, so we should really focus on this despite all the other things going on in the world right now. Chris, you must be a very happy man. News broke in the past week or so that she was going to take an axe to the obesity strategy. Everything seems to be on the table, including the hated sugar tax. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this? Do you think it's good prospects for actually some of these things being rolled back now?
Yeah, I think I'm quite optimistic. I mean, by the time this podcast comes out, we may well have already had the you can't call it a budget. Mm. It's a special fiscal operation. That's the preferred term. And from what I've heard, there is going to be quite a lot in this that is going to annoy all the right people, including probably on the nanny state stuff too. So her whole thing is economic growth, lowering taxes. The controversial bit, I guess, here at the IEA is how laid back she is about deficits and building up debt. But her basic argument is that, I suppose, an element of it is in for a penny, in for a pound. We're already £2.4 trillion in debt. If we have to have a couple more years with high deficits to turn the economy around, and the economy does need fundamentally turning around, then she's prepared to borrow some money to do that. On the nanny state side, you know, she has been, I mean, she's been a good friend to the IEA ever since she's been an MP. I think she was part of the 2010 intake, and she's been in and out of the IEA for all that time, really. And one of the main things has always been, I don't like the nanny state, you know? And if she doesn't walk the walk on that, she won't walk the walk on anything, basically, you know, because it's quite an easy thing to deal with because most people don't really care about it that much one way or the other. You'll get kicking and screaming from various people. Dr. Rachel Clark was in the Sunday Times this week. I don't know if you saw that. She's having a go at me and having a go at Liz Truss for retweeting a Spiked article I'd written once.
There you go.
Saying that Boris should drop the sugar tax. And of course he didn't. And the fact that Boris didn't do anything about it, in fact, made things worse, does give you this, you know, once bitten, twice shy mentality. But I would be very surprised if the special fiscal operation doesn't involve some explicit renunciation of the obesity strategy, certainly, which hasn't come in for the most part, and quite possibly the sugar tax. If she doesn't say that on Friday, I think she will at some point. I think that is doomed now. So yeah, it's nice to have someone who you know, is sound as prime minister. In fact, she's amazing. It feels great.
What do you think, Sam? Are you optimistic where the nanny state is concerned?
Optimistic about the rolling back of the nanny state. Goodness. It's just really fascinating.
There's been a lot of false dawns, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying not to say that, but it's like, you know that sort of Charlie Brown cartoon, Snoopy, where the girl holds a ball and then pulls it away at the last minute every time. He gets flying into the air. It really does feel like that sometimes, the Conservative Party, and trying to get them to do something that's actually conservative. They sort of sit there with these massive majorities and then they sort of behave a bit like the Labour Party, but on a 5-year time lag, which you could obviously attribute to the blob, should you wish to do so. We'll come to that in a moment. The rolling back of the sugar tax is, I mean, it's obviously not had the intended effect, and the obesity strategy, which is sort of coming in, probably won't work either. And it's sort of this ghastly business whereby the fact that Britain runs the NHS the way it does, the fact that the government sort of views people's health as a sort of fiscal cost in this way, has all of these knock-on consequences through the budget, whereby people start going like, well, people can't sort of eat and drink and smoke as they like, because look at the cost it's going to rack up for the NHS, look at the cost it's going to rack up for the taxpayer through that. And they start trying to address it through that rather than by saying, gosh, maybe this socialized healthcare system isn't actually the best idea in the world in the first place. Yeah, so we come back onto point. sorry, I've been in the IEA 5 minutes. I'm already calling for the dismantling of the NHS.
We're recording from the IEA.
Yeah, exactly. So it's having that nefarious influence on
exactly.
the
game. Exactly.
But
the seat of power.
But it was interesting because I remember Chris being very optimistic about Theresa May's impact on was the Tony state. Yeah, no, I think this was in a podcast a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I was struck by the amount
I'm just
of
an optimist, I guess.
Sunny optimist as ever on these matters. But you probably weren't surprised by this, Chris. But the amount of pearl clutching in response to it. So, you know, members of the new Office for Health and Improvement and Disparities organization saying that they were aghast and it was reckless. Even just a general sort of liberal left commentariat see this as such a heresy. You know, I think Polly Toynbee said only extreme libertarians want to do something like get rid of the sugar tax. And what is that about? Because that's really, really odd. I mean, I'm sure you get this a lot. Well, why are you so preoccupied with these nanny state issues and sugar taxes and all the rest of it? I always think it's the complete opposite. Why are all these people from a kind of relatively broad swathe of politics so preoccupied with like this vast bureaucracy, all these incentives just to the end of getting people to eat fewer biscuits? I mean, that's quite weird. And yet it's so built into what it is to be a good government, what it is to be a good person. Where is all that?
Because it's really symbolic. It's symbolic of the likes of Polly Toynbee wanting and assuming that society will always just gradually shift towards more micromanagement of people's lives, a bigger nanny state, basically. And the idea that there can be any bump in the road, any kind of setback, is absolutely shocking to them. And that symbolic gesture of the sugar tax, Jamie Oliver himself actually called it a symbolic gesture, right? Even he didn't really think it was actually going to reduce obesity. But it's symbolic because it means, the sugar tax, as bad as it is for various different reasons, the worst thing about it, I think, was that it cracked open the door to basically treating people who eat food like smokers. That's the direction of travel. We'd never before had any real legislation trying to dictate to people what they eat and drink in terms of soft drinks. And the sugar tax was it. And once that door was opened, it was assumed that you would just have a whole load more legislation, which indeed you did with Boris Johnson's obesity strategy. And so you go from a sugar tax to an ad ban to telling supermarkets where they can stock their chocolate oranges and all the rest of it. And for the likes of Polly Toynbee, you know, the sort of bourgeois liberal left, the possibility that things like this could go backwards at all is absolutely terrifying to them. And it's kind of ironic because they've been moaning for days about the supposedly regressive tax cuts that Liz Truss is bringing in. I'm not even sure there's such a thing as a regressive tax cut, actually, but this would go along with it. The one truly regressive tax in all of this is the sugar tax. I mean, no one can seriously argue it's not regressive. And yeah, you can be sure that if the government gets rid of the sugar tax, there'll be no applause for getting rid of and making the tax system overall more progressive. So they have a massive blind spot on issues like this because it's not about the economy. It's not about finances. It's symbolic. It's very potently symbolic for people who live in Hampstead and so on.
And it's a big impulse as well, just telling poorer people what to eat and how to live their lives seems to be so hardwired into a lot of these people's kind of psyches, I guess. But I mean, Sam, it seems like this agenda, the kind of anti-nanny state agenda, has been given a bit of a shot in the arm by the cost of living crisis because, you know, as Chris was saying, all these things are regressive. Do you think they're going to be able to land that argument that, you know, this is actually about making people's lives better, or is it just going to face all of this usual resistance that they're being horrendous human beings for even touching these things?
I don't think that argument will land for the simple reason I think the people who back a sugar tax will say that it's going to make people's lives worse. And I think you have to sort of get into the mindset they sort of seem to display. And like, I may be horribly stereotyping here, but the kind of vibe I get from them is often that they think they know how to run your life better than you do. It's sort of soft, but well, it's not soft paternalism at all, it's overt paternalism, which they're going to say, you're making all these bad decisions. The consequences will accrue to your future self. I know better than you do what's good for you. That's why we're going to have the sugar tax. That's why we're going to have this tax on alcohol, minimum pricing for units up in Scotland, I believe. That's why we do all these things for you. It's for your own good. So if the government turns around and says, oh, but they can, you know, eat more cheaply now, they're going to turn back and say, yes, and they'll pick the wrong thing and it'll be bad for them, you absolute monster. So exactly. I don't think there's a winning scenario here for them on that sort of front. But I think it's good to push back against it regardless, because I don't really see what business of the state it is, what people choose to eat, so long as, like, you know, there's the maintenance of basic safety rules, which I think maybe even the IA will be sort of we'll go for.
We'll come to Chris in a minute on those questions. Yeah,
exactly.
I'll give you that.
So we'll have the basic safety rules because it makes trade more efficient if everyone kind of adheres to the same standards. We'll go with that reasoning.
Chris, the Rubicon was crossed when they brought seatbelts in. You know that.
But it actually was. Yeah. That's all for another day.
Fantastic. But there's not really much of an externality to it. Like, you can't sit there and say this guy is sort of eating an extra, having an extra can of Coke with like more sugar in it than the alternative formulation is inflicting a cost on me personally. Mm-hmm. And the only argument they have for that, it operates through the NHS, which again, they sort of view as a sacred cow. And they do tend to talk as well about its effects on the NHS, like obesity costs our NHS, I should call it, thank you, this many billions per year. And so it's just a very strange framework to sort of operate through. But once you're in that mindset, they're never going to accept this as being a good thing for people.
Mm-hmm. This is the funny thing about the Sunday Times attack on me by this Dr. Rachel Clark, who, if you don't know her, folks, she's sort of a blue heart, double masking kind of. She got famous for being very hysterical about COVID. She doesn't seem to practice medicine very much.
Is this one who sells masks, or is that someone else?
No, that's Juju, somebody or other. Yeah, Juju or someone. No, she's but similar. She doesn't do any, or doesn't do much in the way of doctoring, mm-hmm. but she does quite a lot of tweeting, and writes some books and so on. And she had a go at me, as I say, in the Times. But the headline was, "Ditch the sugar tax and I will see more of my patients die." Right. Well, the sugar tax, well, firstly, she's a palliative care doctor, right? So if she doesn't want to see patients die, she's a doctor. But secondly, even she didn't really claim or couldn't claim that this has saved anyone's life because it hasn't. It hasn't made any difference whatsoever, really. It hasn't reduced obesity. Obesity is at record highs. It hasn't saved any lives. And there's this weird kind of, what do you call it, cognitive dissonance or something like that, that makes these people cling to the belief that these things are lifesavers, despite the fact that they've been implemented for quite a few years now, and we've seen very clearly that they're not.
But impervious to evidence. But as you say, it's all about politics, isn't it? It's all about kind of...
It's about feeling good, I think, mainly. Mm. You know, these are feel-good policies for people like her.
Middle-class do-gooding and all that stuff, the tyranny of it. Hello, everyone. Me again. We'll get back to the show in just 1 minute. But before that, I wanted to say a huge thank you to everyone who donates to Spiked. I know it's a difficult time out there for many of you, and you still hand over your hard-earned cash in order to fund our work and make sure that we can reach more and more people. I want to let you know that for the next couple of weeks, we're doing a fund drive to fortify us for the months ahead. And for a limited time only, there's a special offer. So those who give £50 or more will get a free signed copy of How Woke Won, the brilliant new book by Joanna Williams. And not just that, you'll also get a year's subscription to Spike Supporters, which is our donor community where you can get access to events as well as all kinds of other exclusive Spiked perks. So in order to make your donation and to claim those gifts, just go to spiked-online.com/donate and fill in all your details while stocks last. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/donate. Thank you all. And now back to last orders. We were talking a bit about the resistance that these kinds of cuts to the nanny state might make, which brings us neatly on to the blob, which you've written very well about, Sam, for us and for many other outlets. There's another hook in this insofar as Tom Scholar, the permanent secretary at the Treasury, I believe, who was sort of unceremoniously sacked at the beginning of this new government, along with some other civil servants, I believe, a moment that naturally was treated like it was the light and the night of the long knives or something, you know, the worst thing that could possibly happen, you know, again, this authoritarian Tory party strikes again. But it's generated a fair bit of discussion, I think, about questions of Treasury orthodoxy, but just blob orthodoxy in general, I guess. So what was your response to that particular moment? But also, if you just tell us a little bit about how you see, you know, what is the blob and what does it mean to take it on, as it were?
So if I start with that end, so the blob is obviously Dominic Cummings' sort of term. It comes from that horror movie where you have this amorphous alien monster that sort of arrives on Earth and starts sort of absorbing everything in sight. And it sort of captures this sort of slightly amorphous nature of a substantial part of British governance. Because there's obviously what you all see on the surface. There's your parliament, the House of Commons, the House of Lords, all sorts of political interchange. And then there's all the stuff that kind of goes into policymaking. Now, if you listen to the sort of people who like sugar taxes, I believe we're actually sitting in the seat of power right now. The IEA runs Britain, according to them. But if you actually sort of...
It kind of does now, but yeah.
But if you actually look at the policies that come through, very few of them are the sort of things that Chris would actually be passing. I may be wrong there, but I think so. And so what actually happens is you have this sort of strange policy-making network whereby sort of ideas sort of come out through academia, they come out through sort of activists in the sort of charity sector, and they're sort of promoted quite strongly, and they sort of make their way into sort of university graduate middle-class consciousness, and from that into the civil service, where it's sort of, it would be very normal as a civil servant to attend, for instance, sort of an Institute for Government event, mm-hmm. which has like a, and like every organization, it has its own sort of, you know, view on things. As a friend of mine who works in the civil service said, it might be looked askance at if you then went and turned up to like an ASI or IEA thing on sort of policy making.
Sorry to interrupt, but what actually is the Institute for Government? I've never understood what it is. I've only ever seen him on Newsnight saying extremely mundane things. They don't seem to have a point of view. What is it? Who funds them? Who funds the Institute for Government?
It's an excellent question. I'll ask Joe Ratter next time I see him. I used to work for, so I should probably be nice about them.
Well, they're just keepers of the orthodoxy. Yeah. I mean, what? What's the
permanent
point of
defenders
it?
Of the civil service.
Yeah,
I think it's right. Well, yeah,
I think that's
the civil service representatives on Earth or something. But right. They seem to be wheeled out at times like this.
I am. Sure, I think that's not. That might be slightly unfair, but yeah, that's kind of the vibe. Yeah. Exactly. There's a very nice chap at the IFG who agreed to be videoed for that blob film I did, so I have exactly. He was very fair. So the problem with the blob basically is that it's not like a coherent entity. It's not like you can't sit and point to someone and say you're in charge of this, you're running it. It's more like, I mean, when you talk to politicians about it, actually, it's quite entertaining. So often say no, there's no such thing as a blob. Oh, it's okay. It's like what you're talking about is the establishment. Or what you're talking about is the orthodoxy. And what you're talking about is a civil service mindset. And it's like, right, yes, but it's all the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that there's like a mindset in government, which is sort of pushed forwards regardless of the intentions of policymakers, and which ultimately ends up inhibiting sort of conservative projects and sort of advancing more left-wing ones. I think that's sort of actually quite uncontroversial when you look at how government actually operates.
Chris, you must have seen examples of this as well, because it's not just the civil service, as I understand it, at least in your reckoning. It's also sort of sock puppet research organizations, yeah. Universities, which take government money and then repeat their own views back to them in this sort of strange, you know, sort of feedback loop. So, I mean, you must see this all the time, Chris, at least in relation to nanny state stuff, where you've just got ministers or civil servants being told what they already want to hear from people who've probably taken a bit of state funding here or there.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's the bureaucracy. I mean, there's all sorts of, as Sam said, there's all sorts of different words for it. I mean, the establishment is a pretty good term for it, I think, actually. Someone like James O'Brien would go like, the establishment is people like Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage. Well, actually, it kind of isn't. And it's not about what school you went to anymore, necessarily, although that probably comes into it quite a bit in the civil service. It's about a general attitude and having your levers on particularly the public purse, you know, so you can dish out money effectively to your friends. And of course, ministers should have control over that, but they don't. The Minister for Health has a budget of, you know, best part of £200 billion. They're simply not going to notice if 50 grand goes out here or £200,000 goes out there to various different pressure groups, charities, advocacy groups, NGOs, you know, call them what you will. And so, yeah, undeniably, there is a blob that has a certain frame of mind, not all of them, and I'm not saying that they're all, you know, conspiring against the people or anything like that, but they, you know, groupthink is a thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, you get groupthink, and the reality is that ministers are turned over at an incredible rate these days, and when a minister goes to a new department, they will take with them at best 3 or 4 spads. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be them against the entire department that's been there for many, many years and have a certain view about how things should be done. And the yes, minister is obviously the obvious comparison. But, you know, the reason that people like Margaret Thatcher liked yes, minister is because it accurately depicted, broadly speaking, through comedy and caricature, the way it was, that you know, you are up against these people who know much more about it than you, to put it simply. You are nearly always a relatively new minister, because ministers don't hang around for very long. And if you want to do something, particularly if it's, you know, considered to be radical by the civil service, they will find ways of slowing you down, kicking the can down the road until eventually you get moved on. And that's why things don't really change.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, despite having, you know, with Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, you could say we've had some relatively radical controversies. Yes. Obviously, Liz Truss hasn't had a chance to have a go at it yet. Mm-hmm. But I would be pretty confident that the civil service will do a great deal to water down whatever Liz Truss wants to do.
But I think it's become a much more conscious process. I mean, you talk there a lot about kind of groupthink and how there's a kind of array of sort of incentives that lead you to a situation in which people tend to think this way and tend to impose it as well. I think particularly since Brexit, it has become a bit more explicit. I mean, people, especially in terms of even just the kind of commentariat, willing on the civil service to do their honourable duty and frustrate Brexit. You see it with a lot of the kind of woke discussions. There was that quote from Matthew Rycroft, Permanent Secretary in the Home Office, saying that civil servants should accept government policy on some issues, but on others it's for us to be the stewards. That was kind of really? In the midst of a lot of this discussion around we need to get the woke stuff out of the civil service, you know, all of these diversity champions on all these kinds of schemes and things which are making things going awry. It has become quite explicit, and also people celebrate it.
It's become explicit because you've got governments who actually want to change things.
That's true. That's true. But and celebrate it on that basis. I mean, you know, the civil service has been elevated into these kind of angels in the same way that any kind of non-democratic bit of the state has throughout the Brexit process. It was like, brilliant, something that will stop this runaway populist madness. But sorry, Sam, you wanted to come in on that.
No, I was just going to agree, actually. As you were saying, I don't think it's sort of so much an overt sort of guided process, but like it's the fact that they all come from the same sort of backgrounds. And you look at the data on this, they all went to the same sort of universities, went to the same sort of educational courses, and they've gone through that same sort of socialization. They go into these organizations which have these very strong cultures which they try to sort of pass on over time, and then they sort of end up sort of leading to this group thing. And it shouldn't really be surprising that all of the people with all of the incentives pointing in the same direction act in the same way. But I think the one thing I push back on slightly with Chris is that I do think actually they things do change. It's just they only facilitate change in one direction, which is towards the sort of things that they want.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But I mean, so to come back to the Treasury though and sort of the dismissal of Scholar, I think it would be absolutely ludicrous for anyone to say that the Treasury does not have an institutional view, because it very clearly does and has done for a very long time. You can go back to sort of the 1930s, 40s, and you'll find people complaining about the Treasury view and what it meant for economic policy. And basically, they've always liked, they want their tax revenue in, they want the budget to be nice and balanced, and that's what they care about first and foremost. Partly because we made a mistake of sort of rolling the Treasury and HMRC into this sort of weird combined organization. But they don't, what they're less keen on is like, investing for growth. And to be fair, I can kind of understand sometimes where that comes from when you see the absolute inane nonsense other government departments will spend money on if you give them a chance to do so, which to be fair is the sort of thing we'd probably be complaining about, sort of like firing out these absolutely vast grants towards these organizations who lobby. But in this particular case, the government's coming in with a very particular scheme for growth. It's what it wants to do. And then it's perfectly well the Permanent Secretary of the Treasury is probably not in alignment on this, and they decide to get someone in place who knows the mechanisms of the Treasury and who also sort of agrees with them. I don't really think that's the burning of the Reichstag. It just isn't.
Yeah.
It's just not, you look at people saying, oh my God, our impartial civil service. Like, well, firstly, it isn't. Not really. And secondly, this is actually quite standard in other countries. Like in America, they bring in a whole sort of suite of top officials because they know that you want to sort of get your hands on legal power and sort of exercise it. And if the minister doesn't actually know how the department works, you need someone who can sort of come in and do that for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm all for it, basically.
I mean, you gestured there to sort of, the liberal hysteria, if we're going to call it that, whenever the government does anything with the civil service. Obviously, the great tribune of liberal hysteria is James O'Brien, who I wanted to talk about, partly because you wrote a very funny blog, Chris, about one of his latest rants. These things obviously always go viral. They're liked and retweeted by all the worst people on the internet. But this particular one, when he was talking about the queue to go and see the Queen lying in state in Westminster Hall, was one of a kind of series of his, if you like, which are just batshit crazy, dipping the toe into conspiracy theory. And it's part of a bit of a pattern, to use a slightly conspiratorial phrase. But Chris, you want to kind of remind us what this one particularly was about and why you felt the need to flag it up, I guess.
James O'Brien talking about the queue, the capitalized queue to go see the Queen's coffin in Westminster Hall. He had some questions to ask about this. He thought it was very suspicious that
Chris is doing the pose, by the way, if you can't see that kind of leaning,
very suspicious that this queue was forming and by its very creation was making people think that maybe lots of people wanted to see the Queen's coffin. And the implication was that nothing could be further than the truth. No one cared less about the Queen's death. And he said explicitly on his show that this has been planned. This is deliberate. Someone somewhere has deliberately decided to make a 5-mile queue snaking around London. Why are they doing it? Why are they doing it? And he urged his listeners to call in and tell him why they were doing it. Now, I only saw the clip on Twitter, so unfortunately I didn't hear what his listeners thought, what theories they had developed about why this queue had been deliberately created. I found this interesting for two reasons. Firstly, he proposed that the much more obvious thing to do, rather than let a queue form, was to have some form of central planning and issue tickets and set up a website, and people could book their times and then they could go in every hour and all this kind of stuff, which is the classic socialist delusion that, you know, something that's spontaneously being created is flawed because people are queuing up, and not because people never queue up under socialism, obviously. And that, you know, wiser people, bureaucrats should have been involved, and they could have created a system that would have worked better. Now, for reasons I explain in the blog post, which is on the Snowden Substack, by the way, folks, like and subscribe. I don't believe it would have been a more effective system. And in fact, it seems to me that people in the queue really quite enjoyed being in the queue.
Similar quasi-religious experience.
Yeah, they loved it, far as I can tell. And if they didn't like it, they didn't have to join it. It was all optional. But the other thing, of course, is that clearly a conspiratorial bent to this. The idea that a queue wouldn't just form, that somebody allowed it to happen, someone deliberately constructed it. The assumption seems to be, as I say, that he didn't really believe that people were that sad about the Queen's death, and that somebody in MI5 had decided to create a queue to make it look like people were bothered about it. And this, as you already alluded to, is not the first time he's got involved in conspiratorial thinking. The whole Nick incident.
Oh, yeah. Carl Beach.
Carl Beach. I mean, taken in by a pretty obvious liar and charlatan who's now in prison, or has been in prison, for saying there was a massive Westminster paedophile ring run by Leon Britton and various other people. There was another one less well remembered when Nigel Farage got milkshaked.
He was a milkshake truther, wasn't he?
This was in the days when people got milkshaked. Just don't see it anymore, do you?
But it's unfortunate.
For a while, people got milkshaked a lot, and Nigel Farage got milkshaked, and James O'Brien was convinced that this was a false flag to distract people. I can't remember what it was that it was to distract people from, so in a way, I guess it worked.
Was it the European elections or something?
I don't think it was even something as serious as that. I think it was something.
One of those people who show up to council to represent their party got milkshaked. And it was. I think it was James O'Brien. It was also bloke's name. I forget. Rupert Myers, I think, famous for other reasons, who was speculating it was actually yogurt because the splash pattern wasn't consistent with milkshake.
Wow, I really looked at it like it was approved.
So there was a few of them doing all that stuff. I think it was the Euro elections.
So I mean, I get the thing is the guy is really just Alex Jones for LBC. You know. When it comes down to it, these people portray themselves as being so rational and sensible and, you know, sane voice in a crazy world. But they are so easily disposed to the most ridiculous conspiratorial nonsense, including stuff previously, you know, Russian interference in Brexit, Russian interference in Trump, Cambridge Analytica, all this kind of stuff. You know, for some reason, conspiracy theories have a reputation as being particularly attractive to right-wingers. And certainly there are plenty of conspiracy theories like QAnon that are attracted to right wings. I would say probably on balance, if you look at every major conspiracy theory in the last 30 years, I would say more than not have been essentially from and believed by the left.
Also, it's this kind of breed of elite conspiracy theories as well, which often when they're quite potent can be much more damaging. Like, you know, a few idiots having a wrong idea about the vaccines and showing up to a hospital trying to take pictures of the vaccine hub or whatever is obviously disgraceful and all the rest of it. But, you know, something like the VIP paedophile scandal, you know, James O'Brien had, I think, Carl Beach on his show speaking for a voice changer, like really bought and sold the whole thing, and it obviously ruined people's lives, spread needless panic, all the rest of it. There's and obviously the Russiagate stuff. There's vast swathes of American liberal opinion, which is that the 2016 election wasn't legitimate, you know, and yet the only one we ever focus on is those idiots who think 2020 wasn't legitimate. But Sam, is this something you picked up, this kind of centrist dad, almost anti-Tory conspiracism? It's kind of my favourite because it's often so ridiculous. There was another one where Boris and Carrie were posing for a photo and they insisted it was a fake baby in the picture. Yeah,
And the Boris phone line, wasn't Boris, remember
the phone line?
The, Robert Johnson.
The cord, yes.
Like the cord's the wrong way in the mirror.
Yeah, and someone had to point out that's just how like optics work.
It's how mirrors.
It's not the first time someone's had to explain something like that to or Robert. But is this something you've noticed?
What friend you of the show, on? Robert. Yes.
There goes my input on his show.
Yeah,
it's definitely a thing, and it's really curious as well because you sort of, as you say, it comes out of sort of the sort of left liberal side, who are also extremely pro government intervention on things like sugar tax and sort of, you know, the state being sort of larger and more competent. So the end of this weird thing where like the state is a completely corrupt entity filled with crooks out to fool us, and also it should be larger and more powerful, which is not exactly a coherent set of beliefs, but then conspiracy theories rarely are. In this particular thing, the Q, I mean, I think the simplest way to point out it wasn't deliberately planned by a state to be this way is that if you'd given the civil service the task of making the Q as long and winding as possible, they would have balled it up and it would have been wonderfully efficient. I think it's like it's fairly obvious that like someone somewhere screwed up in the planning and didn't anticipate how many people were going to come. A ticketing scheme would have been a completely disastrous idea because the whole point of the thing is, as my friends who queued sort of found, it's a pilgrimage. You're going on a religious pilgrimage to see the relics. And you can't really have a ticketing system for that. We just turn up. Personally, I obviously think they should have auctioned off slots to the highest bidder. But
of course you do.
But I think that might have undermined the vibe.
No, so. No, definitely. We've got a bit of time left for the postbag section,
yes.
Which comes with its own jingle.
Postbag. It's bulging, isn't it?
I'm not going to lie, it's slightly slim pickings. I guess people are still somewhat, you know, have only been of their eyes glued to the news. So there's a bit of a theme
still
to some
morning.
Of these. Got one here from Alan Kerr. Do you agree with freedom of expression, even if it is offensive to you, like some Celtic fans holding up a banner saying, fuck the crown, I believe in democracy for all. But unfortunately, after the sad passing of the late Queen, many great commentators I respected as true guardians of democracy have proven themselves not to be. So I think it's going to be an easy question for all of us. But
yeah.
Has anyone noticed that hypocrisy, though?
Because yes.
I haven't seen as much of it, I've got to say, but is this in relation to Republicans and Celtic and all the rest? Obviously, the police behave disgracefully,
I mean,
but you know, in terms of, you know.
So many times, but I mean, really quite incredible acts of police overreach in relation to people shouting things at Prince Andrew or saying, you know, I don't believe in the monarchy. And as you said, Tom, in spite of the hypocrisy, you know, suddenly people are getting very upset about this, Polly Toynbee and what have you. Where were they?
Yeah.
Where were they all the rest of the times? And, I can't remember who wrote about this. I think it was in The Critic, but pointed out that, you know, these things obviously are the same, you know, and the cancel culture does work both ways. And I'm sure everybody in this room would defend the right of people to hold up a white piece of paper at the side of the road when you know the royal family pass or whatever it may be. But having said that, it's not as if people are being forced to take pro-monarchy courses. You know, it's not as if people are being sacked from their jobs for saying that they think Britain should be a republic. So although these things are comparable, it's pretty clear where most of the censoriousness is coming from.
No, I think that's what, and I think the hypocrisy is on that side, as you were suggesting there. Because, I mean, I'm sure there were some commentators, talking heads, whatever, who were calling for these people to be arrested because they were such diehard monarchists. But
I don't think there were.
I didn't see
any of them.
I didn't see it. I mean, all I saw were people who were suddenly, you know, quoting John Stuart Mill, despite the fact that they thought people should be arrested for saying, you know, boys can't become girls or whatever, 6 weeks ago. That's what I saw. But Sam, what's your...
No, I mean, I agree. I'm something of a free speech fundamentalist. I've written about it before. So I would rather keep the state as far away from possible from policing what I want to say and what others want to say. The only thing I would say sort of about the Rangers fans and the Ibrox and that sort of thing is that there is a sort of slightly complicated area, or two slightly complicated areas. The first is when you're on private property and you're sort of exercising your right to protest. Like, what actually does the private property have to facilitate this? And that sort of gets slightly complicated because you sort of, that's how you end up with people sort of pushing, doing these deplatforming campaigns, which I think are obviously net bad for society. Although in the specific case of Rangers, given the mood among their fans, I think they're probably within their rights to say, we don't want a riot kicking off. Could you please not do this? That sort of brings me to the second point as well, which is like to where there is a genuine public order concern. I think it's sort of moderately reasonable to ask people not to do things. But none of this was actually crossing that boundary, as far as I could see. None of it was a genuine public order risk, except maybe the stuff at the football grounds. Mm-hmm. So I don't, I think the police have massively overreached, as they will tend to do if you give them the license to do so.
Mm-hmm. No, completely. And it's interesting, again, it's just people trying to pin it on the yep. Tories for the policing act, despite the fact it was all under a pretty dreadful public order act as it was, but as you know, very fair weather supporters of free speech all around when things like this happened.
Which was also from the Tory era, wasn't it?
Public it was. 1986. It was a response to Brixton riots and the miners' strike.
Yeah, just like Tories.
Dreadful legislation. I mean, actually, I would actually sort of mention on top of this as well, is the police do have this real tendency to, when you give them a license to do so, they engage in what I sort of call morality policing. Mm. Which is where they sort of start to drift away from what the point of the law is and more into like, well, what's the prevailing public opinion here? Yeah, what's the prevailing morality?
And, you on another day, they think it would be the clampdown on the anti-trans people. Whereas exactly. If you're a, you know, an event for the public.
Did you see the video of the guy with the white piece of paper
yep.
talking to the police? Mm-hmm. And he's just saying, if I write, what was he saying? Not my king.
Not my king, yeah.
If he I was write not my king on this, yeah. What are you going to do? And he said, well, we'll arrest you. Why? Because it's offensive. What do you mean? Well, some people might find it offensive. Is that against the law? Yes. I mean, what? Mm. I mean, these guys are so far out of control. It's incredible.
This concept of offensiveness isn't in and of itself is an offence. Is unfortunately quite well established in British law. Yeah, just like the Communications Act 2003, mm-hmm. for example. But it's also utterly ridiculous, and it's this this sort of creeping policing of what you can and can't say based on the hypothetical observer, mm-hmm. Which starts to hold society to the standards of the least reasonable person.
Mm-hmm. And it's often police officers themselves. In a lot of these cases, you find out someone's got nicked under the Communications Act or some of these other pieces of legislation, where it's the reasonable person in that case was just the policeman saying, yes, this is a problem and therefore we need to deal with this. Very, very crazy. We should close out. We've got one more question here, which I think is it seems very angled towards a sort of centre-right think tank mindset or a certain kind. Will building a lovely new suburbia with lots of family homes solve all of the big problems or just most of them?
Well, that's a nice little thought, isn't it? I'm a big believer in building new towns. Mm. I really think it's the solution because, so many people...
Need new Milton Keynes all over the place.
We do. We need them everywhere because it's very difficult for NIMBYs to get involved because it's not anywhere near in their backyard. And, I'm a big believer in building houses and all that, but I do get a little bit annoyed with, centre-right libertarians and what have you. People who believe that their views are rooted in economics going like, it's not fair that we can't build all these houses in where we want. Well, look, the reality is that if you live in a town, you don't really gain anything from loads of houses popping up and more traffic being on the roads. You just don't. So, if you believe in rational self-interest, it's perfectly reasonable for people to turn up to every planning committee and say, I don't want anything built there. You need to either give people an incentive to allow house building, in other words, give them money. And the same applies, by the way, to fracking, nuclear power and all sorts of other things. Or just put them way out of the way. I think it seems to me now too late to stop HS2. I think too much work has been done on it. I know some cost fallacy, blah, blah, blah. But we're a few years into this project now. They're not going to stop HS2. I think they should just build a train line but not make it high speed and build loads of new towns along the way.
Like that kind of Saudi long city that they're planning.
I haven't seen that.
This trippy.
The line.
Line. That sounds great. Yeah, just so do cool. that. They're already charging through people's, property to mm-hmm. build the train line. Stick a few thousand houses up every few miles as well, a couple of stops. Let's do that. We actually might get some benefit mm-hmm. out of HS2. But yeah, big new towns all over the southeast or anywhere else people want to build. I think that's a much easier sell mm-hmm. than... what people actually want, which is more houses in London.
I will disagree with Chris. I think if you actually started building big suburbs in the cities which already exist, I mean, Chris's idea is fantastic as well. But if you were to find a way of doing this, I think you could easily add something like 9-10% to UK GDP easily. It doesn't solve every issue; it just solves most of them. It makes us. Does it make us richer? Mm-hmm. Yes, massively so. Because labor is currently misallocated. People can't start businesses, can't get the jobs they want, can't work in the places they want because housing is too expensive and that has knock-on effects down the economy. So that's firstly, it makes the UK massively richer. And you can go and look at Saul Moretti's paper on this in the USA, sort of an example of how it works. Once the UK is richer, there's much more tax revenue. That sort of plugs a lot of our fiscal gaps, allows us to provide the public services we already want.
Trustonomics.
Trustonomics, exactly. So that helps. Does it help other things? Yeah, it absolutely does. There are lots of young people who are basically priced out of having families. They want to have kids, they want to start a family, they're not doing it. So if you are at all concerned about birth rates, that's where you should be looking, and that's where sort of your Conservatives will come in. If you want to run sort of high immigration policy for the country, which lots of people do, you want to bring in the world's best talent, well, hell, they're going to need somewhere to live, aren't they? So more housing makes it, and, you know, and the more housing you build, the less people are going to feel, you know, it may be incorrectly, but the less they're going to feel it's some sort of zero-sum competition mm-hmm. between the people who are here and the people who are arriving. Mm-hmm. So build more housing helps with that.
Yeah, but you haven't overcome my objection, which is that people don't really want it where they live. And it's a perfectly rational thing to think.
I'm a big supporter of the Chinese model in that respect. Just crack on. It does make me laugh when it's you know, Chesham and Amersham or something. You know, we don't want some relatively nice low rise build obscuring our view from the third floor window of the Green or something like that. I've got no sympathy for those people.
So I would actually say, I'm not actually convinced these people have sort of a moral property right over land, which isn't theirs. And I also don't really like the idea that the government can tell me what I can do on my land. I think that's sort of a slightly outrageous imposition if you sort of look through the history of English building. It's really only since sort of 1930s, 40s, 50s, I can't remember exactly when it was, that you have this sort of planning control come in the first place.
1947, Country Planning Act, one of the most evil pieces of legislation ever introduced.
Back on point, I don't really agree they have this moral right, but even if you think they do, and they definitely have the right to organise, as every group does, this would generate enough wealth that you could just bribe them, pay them off. It's going to be a net gain, there's a dead weight loss we're eliminating. Pay them off. So I'll fill you with Chris on that. Find a way of doing it. Something like street votes, obviously, it's a fantastic idea.
Bribery is always the answer. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, if your policy works, if it increases efficiency, you can find a way to bribe the losers and get them through.
That's a quite positive note to end on, which is relatively rare on this podcast. Sam, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.